He was handsome, charming, clever, and very, very funny.
Here's Johnny.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Johnny Carson hosted The Tonight Show on NBC from 1962 to 1992. He established himself as the undisputed king of late night. This hour, I'll talk with Henry Bushkin about his new book, Johnny Carson, which gives us an inside look at the life, loves, and genius of this brilliant and complicated man. Bushkin was Carson's attorney, advisor, wingman, and close friend for 18 years. And the Johnny Carson Birthplace Museum in Corning, Iowa, will open to the public this afternoon. I'll talk with Birthplace Society President Roger Sorensen about the museum. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Johnny Carson was born on this day in 1925 in Corning, Iowa. Later on, of course, as host of The Tonight Show for 30 years from 1962 to 1992, he charmed audiences with his self-deprecating humor, his boyish good looks, Midwestern charm, quick wits, and his ability to hold his own with the biggest stars in Hollywood. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll talk with Henry Bushkin about his new book, Johnny Carson, which gives us an inside look at the life, loves, and genius of this brilliant and complicated man. But first, let's hear a little bit from the man himself. Johnny Carson began as the permanent host of The Tonight Show on October 1st, 1962. And we have a clip from that first broadcast. Viewers would have seen it in black and white. Johnny was introduced by Groucho Marx. He was 37 years old.
And now, the permanent star of The Tonight Show, Johnny Carson. You'd think it was Vice President Nixon. Johnny, and I didn't have trouble getting the suit. I was out buying some cheese. Oh. Well, you could have used me all this time. I wish you'd tell these people that I was on in the first 15 minutes, you know, in the kind of smallest station.
That's right, Groucho. I want to thank you very much.
I came all the way from California to see you and to wish you luck.
I'm very flattered to come in, and I've admired you so many years that I feel very warm that you would take the time to come in and introduce me on the first night.
The admiration is mutual, Johnny.
Granite.
And as an elder statesman, sort of the Barney Baruch of the airwaves, I want to give you one piece of advice. Sometime during the year, you may get angry and have a hassle with the network. Just go to your dressing room and cry a little and then come back.
That I didn't know about. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Seriously, Groucho, I want to thank you so much. It was very kind of you to come in here. But this is kind of an emotional thing for me because I've known about this show for a long time. And the newspapers and the magazines, and I've probably been interviewed 150 times in the last 9 months since I've known about this. As I say, you work up to it. We come over here this afternoon. We meet the guests that are on the show. And you get kind of charged up. I don't mean to be maudlin about it. But I know that tonight a lot of people, a lot of my friends are watching all over the country. And I only have one feeling as I stand here knowing that so many people are watching. I want my man there.
All right, there was a clip from the very first Tonight Show hosted by Johnny Carson as permanent host when he took over in 1962. And joining me now is Henry Bushkin. Bushkin was Carson's attorney, his advisor, and very close friend for 18 years. He's just published a book called Johnny Carson. Hello, Henry.
Hello, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And let's go back to when you and Johnny first met. How did you get into contact with him?
Oh, a friend of his and a mutual friend, took me up to meet him for a 5-10 minute meeting. It was very difficult because he wasn't open. I wasn't very open. And the only thing we had in common was tennis. And that led to me being hired for the night to accompany Johnny and a few guys to break into an apartment that was suspected to belong to his wife.
Okay, now slow down. That's not a typical job for a lawyer. How did you find out that's what he wanted you to do?
On the walk from his apartment to the other apartment, I was filled in on what was going on, and it was clear I was there in case the police came. I was the lawyer on hand to solve any problems should the police come to try and arrest somebody, I suppose, but that never happened.
All right. That sounds terrifying, though. What did you feel about this?
Nervous. Nervous. I mean, after all, he was a big star at that point. He was 8 years on The Tonight Show, and I was just a few years out of law school. So I had no business representing him in the first place, and then the second place, I had no business going along with it, but I was maybe too young, maybe too naive, but I did, and the relationship lasted for 18 years.
Well, and you really, really wanted him as a client. That was a career maker for you at that point.
Well, I never presumed he was going to be my client. I presumed it was just something he needed done, and it was a matter of a couple of days, and then I'd be gone. That was my assumption.
All right, tell us why he wanted to break into this apartment.
Well, he was married, and there were problems in the marriage. And in New York in those days, you needed grounds for divorce, and adultery was one of two grounds. And so the evidence of adultery was absolutely necessary to file for divorce. So that was the reason for it.
All right. And did you have a plan if you had encountered police?
Sure. I would give him my lawyer hoodoo, if you know what I mean. I didn't know what I was going to say, but fortunately, the police never came. We got in the apartment without incident, got the evidence we needed without incident, and then left.
And this was a powerful experience. I mean, not only was it a very intense experience to be breaking into an apartment, to be alongside one of the biggest stars, probably the biggest star on television at that time, but it was a very difficult experience for Johnny as well, because, as you mentioned, he was looking for evidence that his wife was having an affair. He found that evidence. She was having an affair with Frank Gifford and found photos of them together. It was very clear that it was an apartment that she had rented. How did he react?
Well, it was humiliating for him. It was horrible. It was horrible for all of us who was there with him. But when I was writing the book and writing this chapter, I thought it was so much fun to write it 43 years later or 40 years later, whatever the case may be, because it's tragedy at the time, you know, going to an apartment like that. But 43 years later, when you read it, I was hoping to have some fun with it, you know. It was like a Keystone Cops type of entry that I made into his life, and I never intended for any controversy to come from it, because after all, this happened 43 years ago.
Right.
Like, who cares, you know? But apparently, some people do.
Well, and we'll talk more about elements of Johnny Carson's personal life as we go on this hour. And you mentioned it was a troubled marriage, and he was also not an innocent party in this marriage as far as...
No. He may have been the culprit. I'm not suggesting that there wasn't a reason for the apartment. I'm not suggesting there was a reason for the apartment. Look, if you have a bad marriage, either spouse may do something that others may consider inappropriate, but it may be relief from a bad marriage. Who knows? I'm not condemning it. I'm just saying this is what happened.
Right. So, okay, you helped Johnny Carson on this. You think you were hired as kind of a one-off deal. You go home. What happens next?
Well, about two in the morning, he gave me a call, and obviously I was exhausted, fast asleep. My wife, I had a little baby at home. Everybody's asleep, and he asked me to come down to meet him in a bar at about 3:30 in the morning, which I did. I got up, literally put on a shirt and tie, took it out at 3:30 in the morning as a young lawyer with a briefcase, and go into this bar. It was really a saloon. In New York, and we were the only ones there other than Ed McMahon, who left almost immediately.
Well, and now that
I arrived.
That's very interesting, too, because you write about he and Ed were together, and when you arrived, he basically dismissed Ed McMahon.
Oh, he did. He said, "We're through here." I remember the words, "We're through here."
All right, so Ed leaves, and then it's the two of you. What did you talk about?
Well, I was wondering why I was there, obviously. I had known Johnny all of 2 days at this point, you know. So I didn't know what to expect, but he was drinking, and he started sort of doing, a drunken dirge, you might say, about his life and growing up in Iowa and Nebraska and his mom and his thoughts about his emotions and what he was capable of and what he wasn't capable of. And frankly, that was the most revealing time that I ever spent with him in his entire life. I mean, that was it. I mean, that was as open as he was ever going to be with anybody.
And he also made it clear that he wanted you to represent him in the divorce.
Well, at the end of that, he said, "Okay, go ahead and file for divorce," at the end of the evening.
All right.
He had sort of recovered by the time we left, all the horror and the embarrassment of the moment of that break-in hours earlier was sort of forgotten. I mean, he had that ability to just wipe it out of his mind.
And then you spoke to him again the next day, right?
Sure. Yeah, every day from then on in, for 18 years.
Right, and he asked you the very next day, he said, "What did we talk about last night? What did you tell him?"
Well, I mean, you know, he obviously he couldn't remember. And I sort of described what went on. He says, "Look, don't mention that to anybody." And I didn't. But I do think it's terribly important for the reader and those that really appreciated Johnny to understand, you know, how devoted really he was to the Midwest.
Well, and we will talk about that as well. You mentioned after that you talked to him every day. As you represented him in that divorce, you also then went on to represent him in business and really every element that he needed you in.
Exactly. And at some point, we became partners in a business. So it became more than just lawyer and client. It slipped over to a business relationship in addition to the lawyer-client relationship.
And, of course, a friendship beyond that as
well. Well, yeah, the friendship started, I guess you might say, in 1970. And I think by 1976 or so, we were kind of inseparable.
Well, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking today with Henry Bushkin. He's just published a new book called Johnny Carson. And the book gives us an inside look at the life and work of Johnny Carson for a very specific period of his life. Bushkin was Carson's attorney, advisor, and very close friend for 18 years. Also, later in the hour, I will talk with Roger Sorensen, who's president of the Johnny Carson Birthplace Society in Corning, Iowa. They're celebrating Carson's birthday today with a grand opening ceremony for the museum this afternoon. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Iowa native son, Johnny Carson, who lived in the state of Iowa until he was about 8 years old. And of course, spent most of his time growing up in Nebraska. I'm talking this hour with Henry Bushkin, and he just published a book called Johnny Carson, which gives us an inside look at Johnny's life and his work. And before we get back to our conversation, let's hear another clip from Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. One of his most enduring ongoing skits, of course, was Carnac the Magnificent. He was a mystic from the East who could psychically divine unseen answers to unknown questions. And here's a few seconds from a typical Carnac with Ed McMahon as the foil.
Carnac is attempting to divine an answer while you're sitting here giggling. May I have silence, please?
Yes. You've had it many times before.
May a diseased yak nibble at your drawstring. What to do them to win.
All right, just a moment from The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And, of course, still with me is Henry Bushkin. And, Henry, you write in the book about a party at Henry Mancini's house that you went to, that Johnny Carson was really one of the main guests that was expected to be at the party. And he arrived late. Everybody was worried that he wasn't going to be there. But this was a star-studded party. Tell me about, just give me an idea of who else was at this party.
Well, it was certainly an A-list party. You know, Henry Mancini himself was, you know, at the top of the A-listers with many others. It was Kirk Douglas, Gregory Peck, Sean Connery, Roger Moore, Tony Curtis. It was just chock full of celebrities. And the point of that chapter is to show how important Johnny was in the hierarchy of Hollywood. Everybody was waiting for him because he had the most important podium in Hollywood. You know, he was on every night, and he served as the litmus test of the country. So, and he rarely went out. So him showing up at a Henry Mancini party was a big deal.
All right, so, and you got there first.
Right.
You had told, he had decided that he was going just that day, and you had passed that information along, but he said that you had to be there. And everyone at the party asked you when he was going to be there.
Right, because he was late, and he said he was coming, and he was late, and you might say he was going to be the star of the party, and everybody was disappointed that he hadn't showed up, and I was taking the sort of the questions, like, where is he? And, of course, there were no cell phones in those days, you know. There's no way of communicating other than by telephone. So I had to wait like everybody else, and I didn't know what caused the delay. But once he arrived, all was well. No, all is well that ends well.
Right. Well, I would love for you to describe for us how he interacted with people, because you mentioned he didn't go out to parties often. And he's sort of a riddle in this way, because, of course, we all watched him on The Tonight Show, and he always seemed to be so at ease with everyone. But he wasn't that way in real life.
Well, his personality that you knew, or the audience knew, existed when the red light was on the television camera. When he was off that set, when the camera wasn't on, he was an entirely different person. And that's part of the complexity and the interest in Johnny, because he was so complicated, and it's so interesting to see a guy could be so successful and at the top of his game for so long and have a complicated, complex life that exists beyond television. And that's what this book was about. And look, we're talking about him. It's like he deserves a renaissance. Certainly in Iowa, he deserves a renaissance. And certainly in the country, he deserves a renaissance, because he's iconic. He's the best there ever was. And I've been, you know, asked, well, aren't you divulging too much? And didn't you say too much? Well, you know, you could argue about what I've said, but it was our life and how our lives interacted for 18 years. And he deserves to be known. I mean, this doesn't take away from his brilliance. It just opens up what his life was like, how complicated he was, and how interesting he was, and how fascinating he was.
So,
all of the above.
Would you describe him as a shy man?
Oh, no question. Oh, no question. But you could also argue that he may be the greatest entertainer, because he can go on the Academy Awards and host them and just be brilliant, because he's in command on stage. It doesn't matter if there's a billion people watching. He's on command. You put him in a room of 20 people, and he's shy.
Well, and this party was a wonderful way for you to illustrate this, because he was reluctant to go to the party. He did go to the party. You watched him as he, you know, sort of gets mobbed by people as he comes in, and all these stars want a moment with him. Everybody wants to talk with him, and he has a really hard time with that one-on-one kind of interaction. But then he turns on the entertainer. He starts doing magic tricks.
Well, and one could say he did that because he was uncomfortable, because he didn't have to talk, because he was so good at the sleight of hand with coins and with cards that he could entertain without saying a word, okay, except maybe pick a card, you know, something like that. So he could charm you like that. But it's my belief he did that simply to be entertaining. Others might say he did it because he was nervous.
Well, and it is strange and hard for those of us who are not performers to understand how he seemed to be more comfortable as the absolute center of attention in a room than he was just with one or two people focusing on him.
Well, you know, great actors go on you see them in movies, and they're brilliant. But you meet them in their personal lives, and they're very uninteresting because they got really nothing to say, and they act well. Johnny was very sophisticated and very smart. And so any guests that he had on the show, he was prepared, and he could deal with any circumstance that came up. Carl Sagan, a noted astronomer, author, was a great pal of Johnny's. And few know that Johnny was an astronomer. He had his own observatory at his house. I mean, how cool is that?
You, as his attorney, you also became his business manager in many ways. And he had really been taken advantage of business-wise before you came into his life. Can you describe just briefly what his contract with NBC was before you started doing his negotiations?
Certainly. But before I actually ever met him or started representing him, there was an article in Life magazine back in 1970, in the early part of 1970, a lengthy article where he described himself as basically an unhappy person. And that was his description of himself. And I think you could accept that he was basically unhappy, and that stemmed, I think, from his mother's inability to pass real emotion on to him, and it was hard for him to sustain long-term relationships, particularly in marriages. You know, I'm certain there was love in each marriage, for sure, but he couldn't sustain it, and I think in each case the wife probably gave up. That might have been the case with Joanne Carson, for example, with that apartment. Who knows? You know, she might know, but other than her, I don't think anybody would know. But the point is, he was so different off camera than he was on that he deserves. He really is iconic enough that he deserves the public to know who he really was, what made up his brilliance. There's nothing I've said in the book that I've said to make him look good or bad or indifferent. Same with me. I wrote as our life was and what happened. If the reader is a devotee of Johnny's and he could do no wrong, and some of the behavior that I've described they think is wrong, that the reader don't read the book, you know. But my point here was to show how complex and interesting he really was.
Well, and we're digging a little bit of that out. And I do want to talk about his salary and his contract, because before you started negotiating for him, he had a contract that someone had negotiated for him that really left him in a position where, although he was so incredibly famous and on television every night of the week, it was a significant amount of money, but he wasn't making nearly the amount of money or getting his hands on nearly the amount of money that someone in his position should have been able to get to.
You're talking about a circumstance where he was making $5 million a year and taking home $150,000, if you could believe it.
Wow.
So $4,800,000 plus was deferred to $5 million, which was absurd, but the tax code in the United States then was 90%. So if Johnny actually took home $5 million, he'd walk home. He'd actually have $500,000. He'd have $500,000 left. So the strategy was good, but the results were awful. So that was the circumstance shortly before I met Johnny.
And he lived an extravagant lifestyle, so it wasn't like he was putting any of that $150,000 of take-home pay away.
No, it was obviously hardly enough to sustain a star of his stature in 1970. It was just not possible. So there were other devices that were used, borrowings against that, and so there was debt. And yet you had to pay the debt back, right? You had to service the debt. All of that became complicated, but the end result was Johnny Dyed worth maybe $500 million. So he survived that sort of economic crisis early on and did very well thereafter.
All right. We are going to bring someone else into the conversation. But Henry, please don't go away. We have a lot more to talk about. I'm talking with Henry Bushkin. He is the author of the new book, Johnny Carson, and he served as Johnny Carson's attorney advisor for many years, for 18 years. They were also close friends during that time. And joining me now is Roger Sorensen. He's president of the Johnny Carson Birthplace Society in Corning, Iowa, and they are celebrating Johnny Carson's birthday today with a grand opening ceremony for the museum this afternoon. Hello, Roger.
Hello. Hello.
Hi, how are you today?
Great. Things are great here.
So tell me a little bit about this house. Johnny Carson was born in 1925. He lived with his mother and father, his father Homer, his mother Ruth, in this very small house in Corning, Iowa. Tell me about it.
Yes, his dad worked for the utility company here in Corning, and they had a rented house, the house, of course, where he was born actually in the house. And lived there, we believe, for about 2.5 years. And anyway, we have completely renovated the house and put it back to the 1925 time period when he was born here, and are celebrating that today. We did a major renovation on it and got it to look, had to be close to what it looked like when Johnny lived here.
So when people visit, what will they see? They see a house, a small, modest home, as it was in 1925. Are there pieces of memorabilia that you've been able to collect?
Oh, yes. We have many magazines. We've got photos. We've got a lot of history of the house. You know, it's a very small house, and I guess the thing that inspires me and I think most of the board is it's just such a small house, and to think in the least populated county in Iowa in the Midwest that a star, you know, could be born here and just rise to stardom without any wealthy parents and all that is truly only in America. And I think that's the main focus that we're trying to portray in this house and his legacy.
How did the house survive all this time? I mean, a small rental property from 1925, a lot of those have been torn down.
Yes, it is. It is a miracle almost. The woodwork, amazingly enough, has been pretty much intact and not painted. Some of it may have been a little, and we've taken that off. The ceilings were sagging. We restored them. The floors we refinished. We put it had a foundation with that was pretty weak and just limestone, and we put a basement under it and firmed it all up, and removed the plastic siding from the outside and put the original the original siding was there, and we just replaced a few boards, but. We also exposed the two porches on the north side. One of a lady lived there during World War II and actually raised chickens on the porch. So it's got a lot of history.
Well, and Corning, as many of us know, is a very small town. You have about 1,600 residents of Corning. What's the buzz like in town about getting this house renovated and open to the public?
Well, it's exciting because almost daily somebody comes up with more pictures or some little historical fact about the house and the family, and we are this is basically our phase one of our total project. Phase two, we want to do the sidewalks, the cement work for the drive for the buses to pull up, and phase three is we want to build a visitor center that will actually have like a mini theater of his monologues and all that. We have that in the house now, but the house is so small when you get, you know, more than 30 people in there, it's almost too crowded.
So you're hoping to have a small theater where a tour group can sit and watch.
Yes, exactly. Plus a lot more of his memorabilia. We've we've just, you know, there's so much that we can't display it all properly in this small house.
And what are you doing to celebrate this afternoon with your grand opening ceremony?
We are going to have Iowa Tourism speaker here, and we are going to the display, of course, of the house and people that were involved in that. Some of our board members from the get-go are going to explain the purchasing and that of the house and how it came about. And we've got several people from different papers that are going to be here with us and going to be, of course, celebrating his birthday, singing happy birthday to him and all that to his memory. Mm-hmm. And we've already had people coming in this morning from quite a distance. And again, it's just a fun day in Corning here.
Well, Roger, thank you so much.
Yeah, you're certainly welcome.
Roger Sorensen is president of the Johnny Carson Birthday Society in Corning. They are celebrating Johnny Carson's birthday today with a grand opening ceremony for the museum this afternoon. And Henry Bushkin is still with me. We'll continue our conversation in a moment about his new book, Johnny Carson. And we'd love to hear from you as well. Share your favorite Johnny Carson memories or ask a question. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Johnny Carson. Of course, he was born in Corning, Iowa. He moved around a little bit after he was three and spent a little more time in Iowa, then moved to Nebraska when he was 8 years old and spent most of his childhood there. I'm talking this hour with Henry Bushkin, who has just written the book, Johnny Carson, and it tells about the relationship that he had with Johnny Carson as his attorney, his advisor, very close friend for 18 years. And you are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Wilbur is on the line in Sioux City with a question I was just about to ask you, Henry. So I'll let Wilbur ask the question. Hi, Wilbur.
Good morning, Gertie.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes, Henry, the question I have for you is Johnny Carson, I can recall him on the air referring to as Bombastic Bushkin. And I wondered where that came from. Was that a handle he gave you or his comedy writers, or did you come up with it? What's the story on that?
A poker game at my house. And some writers, Johnny, myself, the producer, some friends were in the poker game. And there was a particular hand, and one of the writers that I happened to win on a bluff. And he said, Bombastic Bushkin does it again. Some line like that. And that stuck. And that was written into the show, and that's how it began.
Oh, okay, that's very interesting. Thank you very much.
All right.
You're quite welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Wilbur. And now there's a little more to the story, though, Henry. When you were pretty excited about the fact that he was going to use Bombastic Bushkin in the monologue on the air, and you called your family, your mom and your dad, and you said, hey, something big is going to happen on the show tonight. Be sure to watch. How did your mother respond to this?
Well, I knew it was going on. Johnny told me he was going to put the bit in the monologue. And, you know, to me, it was a non-event, you know, sort of a nice thing. And it was the first time and maybe the last time it was ever used. So I called my mother and said, look, watch the show tonight with Dad. And, you know, there's going to be something. You'll have some fun. Watch the show. So she did. And immediately after the show in Florida, which was, I'm in California, she was crying. She said, you know, what did you do wrong? I mean, what happened? Why is he saying this about you? She took it quite seriously, you see. And so Johnny, as sweet as he was, he called her the next day. And my mother's name was Mary. He says, now, Mary, it was a joke. He did like a Jack Benny routine with her because I was with her when he called her. So it was very sweet, and she took it, and then she loved it. After that, she loved it.
Well, and of course, it became a recurring bit on the show, as Wilbur mentioned. And later on, you also discovered that which President Bush was actually nicknamed Bombastic Bushkin?
It was It was the last President Bush. And when he was at Yale, I'm told, now I don't know, this may be apocryphal, I don't know, but I'm told they referred to him as Bombastic Bush.
So now that we've moved to the subject of presidents, I want to talk about the inauguration of Ronald Reagan, because that was an event, and Johnny stayed out of politics. Of course, being on The Tonight Show, he wanted to make sure that he didn't alienate anybody. But when Ronald Reagan was elected, Frank Sinatra was asked to produce the whole inaugural event, right?
The inaugural gala, that's right. And he co-opted Johnny to host the gala. And the evening, as it turns out, we were hoping for a terrific weekend, a great evening. Everything went wrong that weekend, just everything. And it resulted in me essentially being fired. But a call from the President of the United States, President Reagan, to Johnny, apologizing for the various mishaps that weekend, saved my job and soothed his feelings enough that we worked another 8 years together.
Well, you have some amazing snapshots in the book from that event. I mean, you have a picture of Frank Sinatra angrily, it looks like, telling Dean Martin, who is clearly drunk, to go sit down. It sounds like it was quite the debacle.
Well, that was rehearsal, of course. And later that evening, when everybody was in tux and the show was about to begin, Dean was the same way, only he couldn't get out of his seat in the dressing room, in the green room. So it was tense because he was insisting on going on, and Johnny was insisting that he's not going to introduce him. And Sinatra finally came in and said, "Dean, you're not going on." And that was that.
Wow. Well, let's get to another call, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Karen is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Karen.
Hello. My question is just wondering if Mr. Bushkin has any plans to go to the Iowa birthplace, and if he does, will he think about coming there to sign books?
Well, first off, I would love to. Secondly, I don't want to create a controversy, but my mother's birthday and Johnny's birthday were always the same day, and it was the 25th of October, so I'm not certain where the 23rd came from. Now, I could have been wrong for many years, but I don't think so. So I didn't want to, you know, put a balloon.
Well, you mentioned that before the show, and so we double-checked our sources, and several different ones say the 23rd, but who knows?
Okay.
But you know, I'm sure, as you have alluded to this hour, there are people who aren't happy that you've written this book. I mean, there are a lot of things that pass between you and Johnny that you never would have shared with people when he was alive because of client privilege, really. But you have chosen to share these stories after his death. Why did you make that decision?
Well, I was writing a novel back in 2008, and I never intended to write this book. But in 2008, Ed Hoekstraten, who was the lawyer that succeeded me in representing Johnny, and if you look at the back of the book, you'll see in my acknowledgement, I acknowledge he's the guy who suggested I write the book. Because he said, look, nobody really ever knew Johnny. You're the only one who ever knew him. And I worked for him for 9 years, and I didn't really know him. So why don't you write that book? People would love to read it. That's how it came about, from the lawyer that succeeded me. And no, there's no privilege that I've violated, because that ceases on death. And I'm not sure that there's anything that I've discussed in the book anyway that has any lawyer-client privilege attached to it. But the real answer is I'm delighted that people are talking about Johnny. He deserves a renaissance, and this book is helping in that. Look, he died without a funeral. He died without a memorial. He faded away after The Tonight Show. Nobody heard from him after he left the air. And now Iowa Public Radio is talking about him. I would love to appear in Corning and sign some books to help revive his memory. This book is what our life was like. And if you're a diehard Carson fanatic who doesn't want to hear anything that the reader might construe as bad, it's a good idea not to read the book. But books are also a Rorschach test for the reader. They bring their own prejudices to it. So if I feel good about writing the book. I'm delighted people are talking about him. He deserves it, and he's iconic. He's the best there ever was.
Now, there was something that you wrote in the book that I thought was very telling. And now, as his attorney, and he was your number one client, you spent time with him every single day. You guys had a standing tennis match every day, and you had dinners together, and you went to him whenever he called and asked you to come, and you went on vacations together with your wives. You spent a lot of really intense, intimate time together. You went to Vegas without your wives, and you did a lot of things together. And at one point, he referred to you as his best friend, in a public way. I can't remember what the circumstances were, and that surprised you. Why did that surprise you?
Because it's very hard in a lawyer-client relationship to ever forget that there's a lawyer-client relationship. And the friendship exists because of the lawyer-client relationship. So he could feel completely comfortable in that sense, and refer to me as his best friend. He could do that. I could never do that because I was never that comfortable because of my role as the lawyer.
Right. That's okay. Don't get upset.
No.
About your
dogs were barking.
Yes,
I'm
we
sorry.
Can hear them. That's okay. Those things happen. All right. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can at 866-780-9100.
I apologize.
Oh, don't worry about it. Let's go back to the phones. Reno is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Reno.
Hi there. You listen, these are a couple, I don't know what you call them. I don't know if you call them urban legends or legends, but I won't get too I don't want to call graphic, but there's been two things. One about Arnold Palmer's wife coming on there and him asking, what does he do for good luck for Arnold? And he mentioned something about making the putter stick stand up. And then the Fred Fawcett, she had a cat in her lap, and he offered...
Oh, that was actually... The urban legend is about Zsa Zsa Gabor having a cat in her lap. But there are a lot of crazy stories. And Henry, a lot of those early tapes have been lost, so we can't go back to the tape and actually check things like that out.
NBC destroyed the tapes. That's the fact. So we can't. And I think the Zsa Zsa Gabor bit is an urban legend. And I'm not certain about the other. I'm really not.
All right. Although, you know, a lot of Johnny's conversations and monologues were rife with double entendre, so that was
and many are still available, you know.
Right.
So it's not like you can't research it. There's a lot available.
All right, Reno, thanks so much for your call, and you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Henry, how did your relationship with Johnny end?
It ended badly. We had built a company that was doing quite well by 1987, and we were generating lots of revenue and producing a good many shows, and Johnny felt that was taking too much of his time and too much of my time away from his time. So he wanted those companies shut down. We had spent 7 years building them up, and we had 100 people working for us, and I resisted because I was more interested in the growth of the companies than watching over the Tonight Show, because it didn't need any watching over. It was a well-oiled machine. And so that's the difference. I left. I was terminated. And then he did. He shut down all the businesses. And I thought that was a very, very unfortunate event. And the lawyer who did that, Ed Hoekstraten, again, as the lawyer who suggested I write this book.
When you were let go, and obviously, you know, that's the kind of thing that happens in business relationships.
It's like a divorce, nothing
right.
more.
How did you feel about Johnny? I mean, as you thought through those years and all the time you gave him, and in many ways, the lifestyle you adopted cost you your marriage, and you adopted that lifestyle to spend more time with Johnny. When you sat by yourself and moved on with your life and processed all of that, what did you think about it?
Today, it's another lifetime. You know, so I never thought about it afterwards. I was very, very angry, very upset for years afterwards. No question about it. But looking at it today in 2013, I look at it completely differently. I look at it as, let me tell it as I recall it happening. And I think the reader should find his life sort of fascinating, because it's not anything they really knew. It's not anything that is shocking in the sense of there's no real dark side. He had a difficult upbringing with his mom in Iowa and Nebraska. She was what I would describe as Midwestern Gothic. She really passed no emotional content on to him, and he suffered by it. But we all knew that, and we all dealt with it. And if that's his dark side, that's his dark side. But he was a superstar, and like many superstars, he demanded, let's say, perfection, when sometimes perfection just wasn't possible, if you know what I mean. It just wasn't possible, and he'd be disappointed if it wasn't achieved. So sometimes he was difficult to please, because after we had obtained the Tonight Show from NBC in 1980, when we wrested ownership from them to him, to his company, of which I was now a partner, 6 months after that, I was fired because his wife had bad seats at the inaugural gala. And the bad seats consisted of being in the eighth row rather than the fourth row. So that is the perilous nature of working for a superstar, because it doesn't matter sometimes how good you did yesterday. It's what are you doing for me today? But he's not alone like that. There's many like that.
Right.
Well, and people like myself, we deal with it.
Henry, we're almost out of time, but
sure.
You have mentioned several times this hour that you think we need to remember Johnny and pay tribute to his genius, and he was a genius. I mean, people watched him on The Tonight Show for 30 years and in many other venues as well, and he had an ease at being a host like that that no one has ever been able to replicate. In 30 seconds, can you describe what the gift that you think we need to remember?
That he was so skilled and so good at his craft from years of training in Iowa, well, really in Nebraska, in radio and early television, and the absolute focus he had on that show was his greatest gift, so the audience could see what a great entertainer he was.
Henry Bushkin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Henry Bushkin is the author of the new book, Johnny Carson, which gives us an inside look at the life, loves, and genius of Johnny Carson. Bushkin was Carson's attorney and advisor for 18 years. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about how we die. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.